land which had been leased to settlers for farming. Well, Patlow is not an Aborigine. She's a white settler who 10 years ago met and married Jimmy Pike, who is. Together, they've made a children's book called Jimmy and Pat Meet the Queen. In the story, the Queen comes to them in the bush and they show her budgies flying free and how to cook a damper on an open fire. In real life, they're going to her to a garden party at Buckingham Palace this afternoon. Pat, just to talk about the bill first, what does it actually mean to people like you and Jimmy?
Well, for Jimmy, as an Aboriginal person, it's devastating. But in terms of his land, it's not as bad as it is for other Aboriginal people, because his people come from the desert and there are very few pastoral leases that extend down that far. So, but it's for other people who live in the Kimberley, which is the region that we live in, it will be very a real setback, because these pastoral leases are vast. They're huge. They're as big as a European country in many cases. And the government wants to give perpetual rights to the lessees, who at the moment have, you know, they lease the land. And they want to give them the rights over and above the native title rights of the traditional landowners.
Now, my understanding was that the Aboriginal argument was that you thought that people could share the land, that the lessees could farm it and the Aboriginal people could use it too. Is it actually possible for those two interests to coexist?
This has always been what Aboriginal people have wanted. This is their ancestral land, and they have from time immemorial been practicing their ceremonies there, following their law, hunting and gathering. The land has supported them economically. And there are many cases where there are what they call good gadia, good pastoralists, who encourage that. They are happy to have Aboriginal people on their land, on the land, sharing the land, because often they can do that without any interference with the pastoral industry. Pastoral industry in the Kimberley, and I can only talk about the Kimberley, things are more complicated elsewhere where there's more heavy settlement, but in the Kimberley, pastoralism is really looking after cattle, and in fact it's been described as periodic mustering of feral herds of cattle. So it's very easy for people to continue their traditional lives on that land.
Now the book that you and your husband have written and done the pictures for really sets out to explain the issue to children and the passion that you and he have for this land. What made you fall in love with it?
With the land? Well, I suppose Jimmy had a lot to do with it. It was love for him that took me out there. But having been out there, I kept thinking of the Garden of Eden, really. In as much as the country was almost unchanged. In some ways, of course, it has been changed. It's lost a lot of its mammal species for various reasons because of feral animals there. But when you're out there, there's just miles upon miles of this so-called desert country, which is actually beautiful country, but there's no water. No visible water anyway. And it was just, I suppose I've always loved countryside and animals and birds and so on, and I feel a bit cheated having grown up in England. I mean, I never knew any of the wildlife here. I saw squirrels and things, but I never knew stoats and weasels and badgers and so on. I wouldn't know north from south half the time, you know. Whereas being with Jimmy, going over his country, he and his, his relations are so in tune with the land. They did everything with their hands, you know, they made everything they needed with their hands. And it fascinated me that people could live there and be so in touch with nature.
But it's not badgers and squirrels that you're talking about.
No, of course not.
I mean, there's this image of you in this kind of Crocodile Dundee's girlfriend style, catching snakes and, what are they called?
Goannas.
Goannas.
Yeah, goannas
which are
big
kind
lizards.
Of reptile,
yeah.
And cooking them and eating them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no badgers, but feral cats are very plentiful, and in fact have been there before white people were there, actually. They're believed to have come with the traders from Asia on their boats. And they live right through Australia in the desert. They don't need to drink water and so on. And we hunt those. They're quite quite commonly hunted. In fact, they're now probably the most commonly eaten mammal in the desert these days.
And there's a description in there of Jimmy doing this for the Queen.
Yeah, we take the Queen
and sort
cat
of burning the fur off over the fire and then wrapping it in and in mud, is it, and putting it into the fire?
Yes, people don't skin the animals. They singe them over the flames, and then when the flames have died down to coals, they line a pit with coals and put the animal in it and cover it up with coals and sand. And then you have a snooze or a cup of tea and wait till it cooks. And then you eat it.
Is it good?
Well, cat, I have to admit, I mean, it's a very nice meat. It's as soft as chicken, but it's got an unpleasant smell. And so I don't relish it unless I'm hungry, really hungry. I'm not a great meat eater anyway.
What about the damper? Are these the things that as girl guides we used to make when you wrap a sort of flour and water thing around a stick? How do you actually make one?
Oh, well, it's based on the traditional method of... originally, people used to collect seeds, grass seeds, which I can tell you is very laborious. We spent a half a day collecting grass seeds, and all we got was a little cake out of it. These tiny little grass seeds you collect, and then you have to separate them from the grass and from the dirt, and then you grind them up and turn them into little cakes. Well, nowadays, people use flour and water and baking powder, and they knead it up like bread, and then they make a sort of flat cake, and then, they put it in the coals, cover it up with coals and sand, and it cooks.
Now, the book is about the Queen coming to you. You are actually going to the Queen this afternoon. You're going to a garden party.
Yes, we're going to a garden party, yes.
Do you think you'll meet her and maybe talk to her about the land?
I don't know if we will get to meet her. We hope so, but that would be sort of the book come true in a way. But I don't know that we get much chance to talk. It'd be interesting to see what Jimmy has to say. Yes.
Now, yes. When we look at this whole issue, it does seem to me that New Zealand and Canada have been much more straightforward in the way that they've handled the land rights. In Australia, it seems to have opened up a real flood of racist sentiment. Is that something that you, as a white woman married to an Aboriginal, suffer from when you're there?
Well, no, actually. We haven't experienced any, you know, racism ourselves. Who knows what people say behind our backs, but I'm not too worried about that, you know. But our friends are very supportive. You know, just take us for granted, like anybody else.
What's the reaction been to the book, though? Has there been criticism that you've been pushing the Aboriginal point?
Well, again, you don't hear that. I mean, all I've heard is real, really positive feedback. I've been really amazed at how it's taken off, little publication like that we didn't expect to go too far, you know. But I did have one incident where apparently a pastoralist was saying, that's what they're after. They're after a republic, the Aboriginal people. And, of course, that's nonsense. They're just after sharing their land. Let me just make one point, can I? Putting Aboriginal people off their land isn't just like putting a pastoralist off his land or a farmer off his land. It's like putting the Irish people out of Ireland. They don't have access to their country.
Pat Lowe, thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for...
On BBC Radio 4, the series that takes you to the parts of the world other programmes don't reach, Crossing Continents. Julian Pettifer meets the mining millionaires, the gamblers and the Aboriginal artists of Western Australia.
My name is Mel, I'm your skipper this afternoon. As we cruise downstream, I'm going to do a commentary for you. And if you do have any questions...
Cruising the Swan River from Perth to Fremantle is a lesson in social history. Up this beautiful waterway in 1827 came the British settlers who founded Western Australia. The capital of their new colony they called Perth, said to be the most isolated capital in the world. It's certainly closer to Singapore and Jakarta than it is to Sydney. It's also a very wealthy city, with reputedly more millionaires per capita than anywhere in the world. And according to our skipper, Mel, it's here beside the Swan River that the rich prefer to live.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is it. We're talking some serious dollars and cents now. The first of the big mansions we see along Millionaire's Row is this place to the right with the green shutters on the window. This home was completed in 1985 at a cost of $18 million.
In Crossing Continents this week, we look at the changing fortunes of Western Australia, a state the size of Western Europe, but with fewer than 2 million inhabitants, a state with vast mineral wealth, gold, iron, and now nickel, have brought successive booms and huge individual fortunes. But must the ecstatic highs always be matched by devastating lows? Boom and bust has been the Western Australian way. Today, there are new risks and obstacles looming. And here we are, sailing past the homes of the risk-takers, the chancers and gamblers, who've made and lost fortunes.
And then just in behind the Norfolk pine tree to the right, this mansion is owned by a guy called Mark Creasy. Mr. Creasy is a gold prospector. He paid $8 million for this home in 1995. Was originally owned and built by John...
Well, I'm now in that very house with the said Mark Creasy, looking down on the Swan River, and it certainly is, I must say, a multi-million dollar view. Tell me, how did you come from a childhood in Suffolk and youth spent in London? How did you come to be in Western Australia?
Well, I think I probably, as an impressionable adolescent, read far too many books by people like Jack London. And I got the impression things like prospecting was exciting, and so I decided to become a prospector. Every now and again, someone has a win.
And you were one of the people who did have a big win. Tell me about finding that very large gold deposit.
I found it in a place called the Yandal Belt here in Western Australia, and found outcropping gold. We actually see visible gold poking out of the ground, flashing at you in the sunlight. And famously, as everyone knows, sold out completely in 1993.
Up until that time, when you did sell out for a great deal of money, had you really made any money?
No. What happened was, in the intervening years, I made a few quid, spent it, went broke, made a few quid, spent it, went broke, you know, and they went on for 20-odd years.
And that's very much the story of Western Australia itself. Periods of great prosperity and growth, followed by spells of economic gloom and stagnation. Ever since the first gold rush a century ago, it's precious metals and minerals that have made fortunes here. And today, 30% of the whole nation's wealth is generated by this one state. Following the fortunes and the failures of the mining industry is the Perth financial journalist Tim Treadgold. I asked him how today's prospectors compare with the old-timers.
It's still a frontier mentality, a get-rich-quick mentality, but they're pioneer people with mobile phones, cell phones, call them what you like, and global positioning systems and all-terrain vehicles and aeromagnetics and Landsat imagery and you name it. They've got some of the slickest technology you can possibly imagine. And you can actually go out into the bush and peg a claim over your laptop computer and lodge the claim back at the mines department in Perth from the front seat of your car.
So there are still fortunes to be made, even though all one hears in the national news is of fortunes being lost.
This is AM. I'm Peter Cave. Good morning. The governor of the Reserve Bank has dashed hopes of another cut in interest rates aimed at propping up the sagging Australian dollar.
Our exchange rate has already...
Australia is heading for hard times. The stock market is nervous, the dollar is tumbling, and all the talk is of the Asian economic crisis. And yet here in Western Australia, even though Asia is very close to home, there's still long-term optimism. Western Australia is different, that's the theory. With its huge resources of minerals and its discoveries of offshore oil and gas, it will weather the Asian storm. That's Tim Treadgold's view.
The Asian crisis is very serious for Australia and very serious for Western Australia. It is not, however, the end of the world. For the Asian economies to trade their way out of their extreme difficulty, that means exporting more cars, air conditioners and widgets to North America and Europe. They require the inputs of iron ore, nickel, liquefied natural gas, all the inputs that go into their export engines. That's what we sell to them. We will suffer. We will see our growth rate decline. I don't believe we'll go into recession. We are talking about Western Australia. Western Australia is a different economy to Australia. It is reluctantly part of Australia. We tried to secede in the 1930s and failed. We accept that we have to be considered Australian today, though at times it's convenient to deny the connection.
If success and isolation make Western Australians feel special and different, there's nowhere in this huge state as different as Kalgoorlie. Kalgoorlie, Australia's original gold rush town, is famous for its golden mile of mines and for the legendary qualities of its hard-bitten, hard-drinking miners.
A young man left his native land. The trade was bad at home. To seek his fortune in this land, he crossed the briny foam.
Well, I followed the route of the early prospectors who spent weeks trekking in from the coast. Well, these days it takes less than an hour by air, and like those pioneers, I've landed up in the pub. A century ago, there were 93 pubs and 8 breweries in Kalgoorlie for 30,000 people. Today, the drinking has slowed down a bit, but there's still about 30 pubs catering for the same number of thirsty miners.
But opportunities, according to certain people here in the goldfields, are not what they used to be. The threat to prosperity comes not from the Asian crisis, but because of a bitter battle over land between Aborigines and mine owners.
We've got in Australia a very divisive element between those who are the wealth creators and the others that are the wealth destroyers. And it's really, it's like a civil war.
Ron Manners sees himself as a wealth creator. He made his millions in Kalgoorlie, prospecting and mining for gold. But the wealth destroyers, he says, are now closing down opportunities, particularly the federal government that has given in to Aboriginal demands over land rights. The story goes like this. In 1993, following a famous High Court case, the government passed the Native Title Act. This legislation gives common law rights to any Aboriginals who can prove customary and traditional use of a piece of land. And across Australia, this has created chaos. Here in Western Australia, the law now obliges mineral companies to negotiate with native title claimants about all activities relating to exploration and mining. It's extremely complex and time-consuming. And as an angry Ron Manners told me, it holds up development.
Well, it stopped it in many cases. It's very frustrating being in the front line trying to negotiate access to land, whereas it was just available before. We don't want the sole use, but we do want the freedom to explore and develop and generate the wealth that is needed for our country.
This is our land, and we want to be involved in looking after our land and what is happening on our land. And Native Title brings that about.
Murray Stubbs is one of Kalgoorlie's Aboriginal people. I talked to him in a pub where a few years ago he would have been barred entry. Even today, most of his people survive on the margins of society, and they've shared very little of the vast riches of Kalgoorlie's mines. With Native Title, they can now claim part of the action. Murray Stubbs is an Aboriginal legal services negotiator, one of an army of lawyers and administrators who are fighting bitter and lengthy battles over Native Title. It's a struggle for jobs, heritage and money.
We as the Aboriginal people, we're not against mining, but we want to protect sacred sites. It's our culture. We want to preserve it.
It is said, it is claimed, that 2,000 mineral applications in Western Australia are being held up at the moment by this question of Native Title. And is this not damaging to everybody?
We can be accused of holding up the mining, but one thing about Native Title, what it does is it basically gives us as Aboriginal people the right to sit down and talk with the company. Whereas in the past, the mining companies could go wherever they liked and done whatever they liked. Now, today, they must sit down and consult with Aboriginal people.
Put that way, it sounds reasonable enough. But Native Title has become the most controversial and divisive issue, and unfortunately the focus of anti-Aboriginal sentiment. Last month, as we've all been hearing, Native Title was used by Pauline Hanson, Member of Parliament, and her right-wing One Nation party to stir up racist feelings and to attract nearly a quarter of the vote in the regional elections in Queensland. Fears over what might happen in national elections that must be held in the next 8 months yesterday panicked the government into pushing through new legislation that waters down native land rights and which they hope will slow down the Pauline Hanson bandwagon. Even here in Western Australia, a recent opinion poll gave her One Nation party 25% support. Despite the acrimony, I've also been seeing cases where Native Title is not an obstacle to progress. Where the stakes are high, big mining companies have learned to pick their way through the legal maze.
And now in this place called Murrin Murrin in outback Western Australia, hundreds of millions of tons of nickel and cobalt ore will soon be mined, processed, and sent to markets of the world.
The Murrin Murrin nickel mine, 4 hours north of Kalgoorlie, represents an investment of $1 billion, and it's about to go into production. Andrew Forrest, the man who made it happen, is 37 years old. Apart from raising the finance, the biggest achievement of this precocious millionaire was to negotiate numerous conflicting Native Title claims. Andrew Forrest has listened to the Aboriginals and to what they want. He's also put $62 million of his own money into the mine. He's taken a big gamble, and so far proved the cynics wrong.
We settled 26 competing Native Title claims to get this project up and running. And to have 26 means you've just got a legal jungle. We settled each and every one of those by basically saying to people, we will aim at 35% Indigenous people in these highly qualified positions. And that's simply by turning the whole show around and saying, we'll start with committing the jobs. Now, Aboriginal population, you elders have to help us and just get into all the basic skills which come long before the job, such as personal sanitation, things which you and I take absolutely for granted. And then they have to be taught the normal personal disciplines which we take for granted. If they get thirsty at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's called as a euphemism in Australia, walkabout. That's rubbish. That's an excuse as I don't want to work anymore. I feel like I'm having a beer, and they just walk off the job. They have to be taught that is entirely unacceptable, and they've got to see their way through that.
Andrew Forrest is a testament to the spirit of Western Australia, to the risk takers and gamblers. There will be another gold rush and a nickel rush, and the booms and the busts will go on and on. The first millionaire I met, gold prospector Mark Creasy, has not given up. Despite making his huge fortune, Creasy told me he still has his old pickup truck in the garage and he's still got gold fever.
I'm absolutely sure myself there's at least one major gold deposit left in Western Australia which is going to be poking out of the ground just waiting for someone to drive up to in his vehicle or walk along or kick a rock or something, and there it is.
What do? You come out here, just buy a shovel and go out into the bush?
Well, first of all, you've got to have, I suppose, the ambition. You've got to have a vehicle, and you've got to have some camping equipment. Once you've got that, native title aside, and providing you've got free entry, you just go straight out into the scrap and get on with it.
There's another business that's booming in Western Australia, but you won't find it quoted on the stock exchange. It's the marketing of Aboriginal culture. Wandering around shops like this one in Perth, I'm amazed at the range of products sporting the Aboriginal label. Books about Aboriginal myths and legends, languages, medicines, place names, and of course food. And then there are racks of spears and didgeridoos and shelves of shields and boomerangs and carved emu eggs. At the top of the market are the Aboriginal painters. Last year, their works grossed $40 million in international sale rooms. But has it all gone too far? And who's making the profit? The Dumbutung Aboriginal Corporation was set up to help Aboriginal artists and to protect them from exploitation. I'm off to meet its founder, Robert Eggington, who's himself an Aboriginal painter. For those of us who really know very little about Aboriginal art, what is different about it, Robert?
To our people, our art is a reflection into something precious, obviously, which is our religion and our spirituality.
I mean, what strikes one immediately when you look at it is that, first of all, it is made up of groups of coloured dots, and all the techniques, presumably, are just handed down. I mean, it's not an academic subject.
Well, certainly there's no form of institutionalised learning regarding Aboriginal art, and I suppose that's one of its greatest aspects is the fact that, you know, Aboriginal culture, and in particular Aboriginal language, was never a written language. So the art itself was one of the teaching methods, and all of our laws and how to live life, if you like, in relationship with the land and animal life forms are all told through our artwork. So it became like a communicative process, and I think that's why it's so very important to our people.
Yeah, but it clearly seems to communicate to others as well. I mean, how do you account for the fact that Aboriginal art, not just visual art, but music and the whole heritage, has become so mainstream now?
Well, I suppose in some situations, obviously, people religiously are wanting to look for options and alternatives to structured Western religions, such as, you know, Christianity, let's say, is broken down to some degrees, and some of these options are looked for in Indigenous cultures around the world. And, you know, Aboriginal art becoming internationally popular is not just an advantage to our culture and to our art, but there's also some great disadvantages in that process as well. We also see where in the New Age market, commodities that bear Aboriginal imagery like tarot cards and, you know, the music part of our culture, like the appropriation, if you like, or the exploitation of the didgeridoo is being adopted and, you know, intermingled with other forms of music, which has resulted in this sort of New Age sound. Again, you know, non-Aboriginal people adopting Aboriginal names that are part of that that infiltration and carrying out what we call falsified ceremonies and, you know, really playing Aboriginal, if you like. And, you know, in that process, it demeans the spirituality of our culture. This is not a toy or a product that one can just adopt or steal.
Robert, I walked out of my hotel in Perth this morning and just across the road, I came across Aboriginal Art Gallery and Emporium, a huge shop. Now, what do you think about it? Does it please you that there are these big shops selling, allegedly selling Aboriginal art?
Well, all of the Aboriginal art galleries in this city here that market Aboriginal art are all non-Aboriginal-owned galleries. You know, the concern here is that, you know, you've got a lot of non-Aboriginal people who are making huge profit margins in relationship to the marketing of our art and our culture. You know, I've got other stories of where the didgeridoos that are sold through these outlets are now being made by Indonesian people. And we should never lose the sight that the didgeridoo was an extremely sacred object to our culture. Didgeridoo in our old ways was never to be heard by women, or women were never allowed to be anywhere near where the didgeridoo sound was coming from, because it was used for men's ceremony and it was used to bring young boys through to manhood. Now, what saddens a lot of our elders today with the didgeridoo is to see it being played from everywhere, from the London Symphony Orchestra through to rock bands and, you know, everything else in between. It's become, I suppose, like an icon. And that the benefits of marketing culture comes back to our people and back to our community. So, you know, we can put those profits, if you like, to work in order to, you know, again, bring some of our communities up out of fourth world conditions.
Robert Eggington, thank you very much. I've left Perth with its gleaming high rise and its teeming central business district and sailed down the Swan River to the twin city of Fremantle. But not the identical twin. This is altogether more relaxed, elegant, and yet raffish. Full of health food and craft shops, sitar music and Chinese herbalists. A melting pot for alternative lifestyles and new age ideas. And I'm here in search of Australia's new man. Now, over the years, the Australian male has become a bit of a caricature, a loud, laddish figure. An ocker whose main interests are footy and surfing, and whose idea of gourmet cuisine is a meat pie and brown sauce. So, Australia is perhaps the last place you'd expect an American-style men's movement to catch on, but apparently it has. Here, in a Fremantle waterside cafe, I'm having a cappuccino with Bruce Russell. Thanks for coming, Bruce.
No worries, mate.
Now, Bruce is a novelist who also runs a men's theatre group, and I've asked him to give us his take on Australia's new man. Bruce, the next few minutes are all yours.
Julian, I read in one of your British papers recently that the image of the Australian man as a lager-swilling, Sheila-groping yob has been transformed. Consultants, I read, have been drafted in to rebrand the wild colonial male as a Chardonnay-sipping culture vulture. We Australian men are bedeviled by stereotypes. Just as America never quite recovered from its cowboy beginnings, and Israelis are still seen as a nation of soldier settlers, Australian men have also had to carry the burden of the frontiersmen with them for a long time now. Bazza McKenzie and Crocodile Dundee are simple distortions of the same idea. And all of these myths have in common that we men are an insensitive lot, given to action rather than reflection. No worries, mate. But here in 90s Australia, we're seeing the emergence of a man who carries his masculinity in a less strutting, jaw-jutting way. Steve Bidulph, self-styled guru of the new man in Australia, has sold more than 500,000 copies of his book, Manhood, subtitled An Action Plan for Changing Men's Lives. Bidulph's key message is that men can step out from behind those billboard-sized stereotypes and say, excuse me, but this is who I really am. But in comparison with the sales of Bidulph's book, membership of what is optimistically called the men's movement is minuscule. Here in urban Western Australia, in other words, about 1.5 million people, there are only 10 active men's groups with about 250 members. For them, Manhood, the book, is a self-help manual. But the men's movement here is slightly embarrassing to my mind. I received an invitation to a men's gathering recently. It was illustrated with a picture of four men wearing ponytails and baggy shorts, self-consciously hugging each other. Not that there's anything wrong with that, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, but it all seems a bit daggy. I don't like gurus, and I don't make personal action plans anymore. In 1996, I started a men's theatre group here called Playback Jack. I recruited engineers and motor mechanics, teachers, and a professor. We continue to rehearse our form of interactive theatre every week, perform regularly, and work with the life stories that eventually become our script. So, Julian, working with men like this at the heart level, I've learned that most men are clumsy, awkward creatures when they come to the stage, yet when they express themselves, there is great beauty. It's a bit like seeing the papier-mâché mask of Crocodile Dundee explode, and when the dust settles and we look again, we see every man.
And I have to say, Ruth, I've never really believed in that awful Australian stereotype. What I've always admired about Australian men is that marvellous candour. Thank you, Bruce Russell.
As these model down to the inside began pretty well, Patton Boy began brilliantly, and in the centre going fast was Ezon Boy, and the girlie fast.
This is another haunt of the traditional Australian male, a favourite spot for the extravagant risk-takers of Western Australia. But this time, they're not gold prospectors, they're gamblers. I'm in a Perth betting shop surrounded by screens showing horse racing from all around the country. It looks harmless enough, but gambling has recently become a matter of serious concern. For one thing, its turnover now makes it the nation's largest single industry.